the San Francisco Experience podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy, independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 26, Episode 10, Defending Australia Against China Without AUKUS, The Echidna Strategy, talking with author Sam Roggeveen of the Lowy Institute. Hello, Sam.
G'day, Jim. Nice to talk to you.
Same here. In 2021, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia formed a security partnership called AUKUS to share nuclear submarine technology with Australia. The US and UK have been sharing such technologies since 1958. Under the AUKUS agreement, Australia will acquire 8 nuclear-powered submarines armed with conventional weapons. The agreement also provides U.S. and U.K. submarines port facilities near Perth, Western Australia, and includes the development of other weapons technology among the three countries. Our guest today challenges the underlying assumptions of AUKUS and proposes an alternative called the Echidna Strategy, named after Australia's porcupine-like mammal. Sam is director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute, Australia's foreign policy think tank. He joins us from his office in Canberra, Australia, the nation's capital. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate your interest.
Sam, please take a few minutes to tell us about your background and your work at the Lowy Institute.
Sure, thank you. Well, your listeners may be curious about my surname. It's of Dutch origins, and I was born in the Netherlands, immigrated to Australia when I was 7. This is an immigrant nation, much like yours, actually even more so than the US. About 30% of Australians today are born overseas. Mm-hmm. And my interest at high school began to turn towards military and strategic issues. I wanted to be a fighter pilot, as many kids have my age did when Top Gun was coming out.
Right.
My poor eyesight put paid to that ambition, but my academic interests began to develop in foreign policy and international security. So I studied it at university. I then joined the public service and I worked in our intelligence agencies, both in the Defense Department and then later in an agency called the Office of National Assessments, which is our equivalent to the DNI, as it would be, as it's called in Washington, the Senior Intelligence Analysis Agency.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, during that period, I became interested in new forms of publishing. Blogging was particularly big at the time in the early 2000s. And the Lowy Institute was a new think tank in Australia, and we connected around that idea because the Lowy Institute wanted a blog and they needed someone to edit it. And was I interested? And yes, surely I was. 16 years later, I'm still at the Lowy Institute, and the blog that I founded, The Interpreter, which your listeners should visit, is still a staple of the foreign policy conversation in Australia, and increasingly it has a global presence. It has a very loyal readership among Asia watchers in Washington, for example. But nowadays, I focus on security research, including on Australian defence policy, and hence the book, The Echidna Strategy.
Very impressive. Sam, what is AUKUS and how did it come about? It seemed to spring out of nowhere.
It was an incredibly well-kept secret. In fact, in a project that I think is full of many strategic but also practical shortcomings and errors, one of the most impressive elements about it was how well it was kept a secret from seemingly everyone except a very tightly held group in Australia and the US and the UK. In fact, in the aftermath of the announcement, I remember talking to a few of Australia's most senior journalists here in Canberra, and they said they had no clue, and that is very unusual. So it was very tightly held. It's an agreement, as you said, but in your introduction, between the three countries first and foremost to procure 8 nuclear-powered submarines for Australia. Yes, there are other technology elements. And, you know, people who work in this field, who work in the Australian Defence Department, will regularly say to me, well, you know, AUKUS is not just about submarines. And my answer to them is, yeah, sure, but it's mostly about submarines.
Right.
That is the big ticket item. And the proposal is for Australia to firstly introduce 3 and maybe up to 5 Virginia class nuclear powered submarines built in the United States. At least the first one of those will be a refurbished vessel that's already in service in the US Navy. The rest will be new built. And then after 3 to 5 US Virginia class vessels have been procured, we will introduce a new class of nuclear powered attack submarines designed primarily by the United Kingdom. At the moment, we know that only by the moniker SSN AUKUS. That's all we know it as. And it's purely an idea at the moment. We can't even say it's a paper design because none of the work have actually been done. You know, a lot of the commentary here in Australia is about just what a colossal practical task we are taking on here. Not just these two, introducing 2 new classes of submarines into Australian service, but a new propulsion technology. We have no experience with nuclear power in Australia, let alone with nuclear propulsion. On top of that, of course, we're also proposing to refurbish the existing diesel-electric submarines that we have in our fleet, the Collins class. So we're going to have 3 overlapping, highly expensive and technically demanding projects, submarine projects that we're taking on. So yeah, a lot of pragmatic skepticism here in Australia. I am in that small group of people who is actually not just a pragmatic skeptic, but a strategic skeptic, you might say, someone who says that not only will this be incredibly difficult to do, but strategically, it's not in our interest to do it.
Before we launch into the book, just for the benefit of our listeners, a little bit of a geography lesson here. Australia, of course, is the island continent. It's about approximately the size of the continental United States, of course, not including Alaska. Australia has a coastline of 16,000 miles. And Australia also owns 8,200 islands in the Indian Ocean, off the coast of Australia, down towards Antarctica. That's a huge amount of territory, coastline, and island real estate to have to defend. So it would seem to me that Australia's Navy and having submarines is something that, just given that coastline, given its position between the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, Australia has a legitimate reason to have a significant Navy.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I think it's also right, Jim, that you begin our conversation about this with the question of geography, because geography is absolutely central to all defence policy and all defence strategy, but particularly this conversation about AUKUS. It's also worth remembering that when you say that the Australian continent is roughly the same size as the continental US, the population is less than 1/10 of the US. At the moment, it's around 27 million people that live in Australia, mostly along its coastlines, barely any inland. That gives you a sense, I think it gives your listeners a sense of the scale of the problem, just as you were doing. Geography is also important in the sense of where Australia is placed in the region. So we're in the South Pacific, but we also border on Southeast Asia. Our closest northerly neighbour is Papua New Guinea and Indonesia. And Indonesia is probably the, if you like, the smallest big country in the world. Small in the sense that it's basically ignored. No one ever acknowledges Indonesia, and it has very little stature in world affairs, but it's over 270 million people. And it's probably going to be the biggest economy, the fourth biggest or fifth biggest economy in the world by the middle of the century. So it's a nascent great power, and that's immediately to our north. And then, of course, you have the rest of Southeast Asia north of that. So a very important region with booming economies. But nevertheless, I think the signature fact about Australian defence policy is that we are far away from everyone. It's often said kind of offhandedly in Australia that the centre of world power and the centre of the world economy and also of strategic disputation in the world has moved closer to us. And that's sort of true. I mean, clearly the centre of the global economy has moved towards Asia, but it's still a long way away. As I often say, and as I say in the book, Beijing's closer to Berlin than it is to Sydney.
Yes.
So we underestimate just how big this region is, and actually distance protects Australia a great deal. It is Australia's single biggest defence asset. Mm-hmm. And the first and biggest problem with AUKUS and with the submarines, in my view, is that it is effectively an attempt to compress the distance between Australia and China, when what we should be doing is exploiting that distance.
Let's move on to the book itself, The Echidna Strategy. You lay out a strategy here, which is one in part. You talk about the distance of Australia. Talk to me about the book. Talk to me about the underlying premises of the Echidna strategy.
Well, the title is a slight allusion to what defence strategists refer to as the porcupine strategy. So you said in your introduction that the echidna is an Australian native mammal that looks a lot like a porcupine. And for many years now, a lot of strategists have advocated that Taiwan adopt a porcupine strategy for its defence against the PRC. And basically what it means is that what they're advocating for Taiwan is to take on a position where Taiwan goes into essentially a defensive crouch. It cannot win a war against China, but what it certainly can do is cause enough damage, enough pain to any invading force, that it makes an invasion look too costly to be worth, the kind of sacrifices that would have to be made. Mm-hmm. You do that not by purchasing large traditional weapons platforms. The Taiwanese are still fond of buying lots of fighter jets. They recently launched a big new, a 20 or 25,000 ton amphibious ship. But instead, what the porcupine strategy advocates is that Taiwan focus on small, nimble, highly mobile weapon systems that make it very costly and very difficult for China to cross the Taiwan Strait and thereafter to actually secure a foothold on Taiwan. Now, I'm advocating something slightly similar for Australia, but the Echidna strategy is really a whole of government, a statecraft strategy, and not just a defence strategy.
Before we get too far into the book itself, let me just share with you the results of a Pew poll that just came out yesterday. The Pew poll, of course, here in the United States, very well-respected opinion poll that measures American public opinion on a whole host of different issues. And starting about 4 years ago, they started doing an annual China poll. And this is a poll of the American public of their attitudes towards China. And let me share that with you because it's sort of hot off the presses and hopefully kind of informs our conversation here, because I'd also like to know the work that the Lowy Institute has done engaging Australian public opinion about China. Just to share with you, it came out yesterday, the Pew poll, 80% of Americans view China unfavorably. 42% of Americans see China as an enemy of the United States. Half of Americans view China as a competitor. Only 6% see China as a partner of the United States. And about 50% think that curbing China's power and influence should be a top policy priority of the administration. And of course, about 61% of Americans are concerned about China's regional disruption. So I just sort of put that out there as regards what the American view of China is today, and it's not getting better. It seems to be getting worse. How about in Australia? How do Australians view China, the CCP, and Xi Jinping?
Well, those are very stark numbers and actually reasonably well reflected here in Australia, although actually the story is of a slight moderation over the last few years. So I can tell you that the Lowy Institute polls Australian public opinion about foreign affairs every year. And every year we ask the question, in your view, is China more of an economic partner or more of a security threat to Australia? Now, in 2018, the figure for China as an economic partner was 82%, while only 12% believed China was more of a military threat than an economic partner. And then in 2021, that figure had changed to 63% believe China was more of a security threat and 34% believe China was more of an economic partner. So that's a radical shift. Mm-hmm. Now the latest figures for 2023 shows that it's moderated slightly, so that it's almost even in the 40-50% range. So maybe we're slightly ahead of where American opinion is. I think it's worth saying, actually, Jim, that first and foremost, that shift in opinion is the responsibility of the Chinese government, the Chinese state. It has behaved in a far more assertive and aggressive way over the last, decade or more, really, since I think we could probably roughly date it to around 2012. But even before then, of course, China began that massive island-building program in the South China Sea. So I think first and foremost, that shift in opinion is down to China's behaviour. And there's been some pretty egregious actions taken against the Australian government over the last few years that we can talk about. But I think also we have to say that the response in the United States in particular, I think the public rhetoric around China has shifted a lot since, starting with the Trump administration in particular. Yes. And I'm sure that's had an effect on public opinion.
And of course, Xi Jinping came here to San Francisco in November for the APEC summit. I had credentials. I covered the summit. I was there when he spoke, when President Biden spoke. It seems as though they sort of agreed to tone down the rhetoric a little bit. And it seemed for a couple of months that relations were moving towards stability. But again, American public opinion doesn't seem to have caught up with the niceties between President Biden and President Xi Jinping. But I just wanted to throw that out there and to give our listeners a sense of what the Australian public is thinking of Xi Jinping and the Communist Party, what the American public is thinking about the party and the Xi Jinping, and how that's going to inform the conversation that we're having about the echidna strategy. It seems as though for the couple of months after the trip of Xi Jinping to the Bay Area that things settled down a little bit, but the relations between the two countries still seem to be, judging by these poll numbers, still seem to be a cause for concern. But let's come back to the echidna strategy and how these numbers can be, what impact these kind of opinions would have on the echidna strategy.
Yeah, look, I think actually what we have to now integrate into our thinking is that relations between China and Australia and also China and the US are going to be indefinitely more confrontational and less cooperative. So I don't see a return to, let's say, the pre-Xi Jinping norm in the United States or in Australia. It is bound to be more confrontational simply because our interests are going to be at odds. China is a great power. It is, by some measures, already the largest economy in the world. No country of that size is going to submit indefinitely to being, if you like, a secondary or subordinate strategic power in its own region. It is going to want to be the leading power. And for China, that means effectively pushing the US out. So the question that the echidna strategy tries to wrestle with is what is Australia's best defence and foreign policy approach in that kind of environment? And I think what we need to integrate into our thinking is a real scepticism about whether the United States is actually prepared to resist China's bid for regional leadership. So it's almost taken for granted, I think, in Washington, that whatever China wants, we need to be against it, and we need to resist Chinese attempts to, effectively wrest leadership from the United States in the Asia Pacific region. The first couple of chapters of my book are really an attempt to question that assumption. Is the United States really committed to defending its position as the leading power in Asia? And then afterwards, assuming it's not, and I think it's ultimately not, then what does Australia do in those circumstances?
Can I just play devil's advocate there? Because in the late 19th century, as the United States was in its rise internationally as a global power, I'd say in the 1880s, 1890s, we looked to the Pacific. We annexed the Hawaiian Islands. We had the Spanish-American War, through which we had a protectorate over the Philippines. We gained Guam. So the United States has been, we have territory. one of our states is in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. We had a very close, still have a close relationship with Philippines, which is under threat in the South China Sea. Under the previous administration, the Trump administration, it's fair to say that many Americans and probably a lot of people overseas saw some of the pronouncements from the president as being somewhat isolationist and what's in it for me and what's in it for the United States and America first and all the rest of it. But the role that the U.S. has played in the Pacific, to say nothing of the World War II, I don't think we're about to cut and run there. I think that in a sense, the Taiwan conundrum raises a lot of questions as regards what we would do, what we wouldn't do. If we take no action, how will the rest of Asia take it? In part, that's a problem of our own making, and it's a problem which prompts questions in the minds of our friends and allies throughout Asia and in Australia. But I think that, you know, given the history, given our history in Asia, I don't think we're about to see, in 1975, when that last helicopter rose from the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, that is not the kind of American policy towards Asia. I think that was more of a one-off. So does Australia have concern about America's long-term commitment to Asia?
Well, that's an open question. So that's being debated among experts. Certainly at the level of governments, there is no question. In fact, AUKUS, which has been endorsed by both of our major parties, is, I would argue, a giant bet on the staying power of the United States as an Asia-Pacific power. I would agree with you that the prospect of cutting and running, sort of Saigon-style departure under pressure from the Asia Pacific, is not likely. That's not on the cards, in my view. What I'm referring to, and what I think we've actually already witnessed over the last 30 years since China really began to rise, is a slow erosion of American authority and American leadership in Asia, simply due to an unwillingness to do enough to counter China's rise. So it's worth, since we're talking historically, it's worth pointing out that in that entire period that you reference from the end of the 19th century onwards, the United States has never faced an adversary or a group of adversaries that had more than 60% of America's GDP.
That's true.
China already surpasses that level. In fact, you know, it may have done so as early as 2014. So the history can't teach us about a threat, or excuse me, of a regional challenger of unprecedented scale to the United States. So the real issue here is if the United States wants to take on a contest of that kind, a contest that will be generational, that will be not just whole of government, but whole of society, far bigger than the contest that it won over the Soviet Union, you need a really good reason. In fact, you need an existential reason. Your motivation needs to be extremely high. And so the question for me is, does the United States have a good enough reason? And what I fall back on is the argument that essentially the United States is an incredibly secure country. True. Despite China's size and wealth, China cannot threaten the fundamentals of American territory, of American democracy, or even of America's economy. And so that's why, ultimately, I argue, no, America will lack the resolve to defend its leadership in Asia. And that won't be manifested through, as you say, a Saigon-style departure. What it will be manifested through is simple status quo bias. So an unwillingness to cut and run, but also an unwillingness to substantially upgrade or update its forces in Asia. And that's what we've seen for the last 30 years. In the face of the largest military modernization effort of any country since World War II, what has the US done? What has the US specifically done to counteract China's rise as a military power? And the answer is actually very, very little. Mm-hmm. There's a natural modernization process that happens in all armed forces, but if you go back to the International Institute for Strategic Studies does an annual report called the Military Balance, which tells you where, you know, US and other world military forces are positioned and how many forces they have. Well, if you look at the one from 1990 and compare it to the one from 2023, they don't look that different. It's still roughly the same number of troops in Japan and Korea. The carrier battle group, the Marine Expeditionary Force in Japan. There's been a slight expansion of submarine capability in Guam, but otherwise not so much. So that, to me, in itself, is a strong indicator of a lack of American resolve, understandably. Mm-hmm. I don't blame the United States. This is not a moral judgment I'm making. It's purely a prudential judgment that the United States doesn't have enough skin in the game to really do this. And so my conclusion is we have to do more for ourselves, we in Australia, but also other U.S. allies.
I can understand that. And if you look, again, coming back to geography, you look at the geography that surrounds China. On the north, of course, the north of China, you have Japan and South Korea. To the north and to the west, you have Russia, which historically has not been a supporter of China. For the moment, Putin and Xi Jinping are big buddies, but who knows how long that's going to last. In 1969, they had a war. Further west, of course, you have India. They have a significant border quarrel with India, so they've got a hostile neighbor on that side. And it's really the South China Sea and Southeast Asia where China, in a sense, looks at all of its surrounding geography, and that's the one piece of geography that where China can maybe gain some leverage, where there aren't, you know, significant historical powers and presence as it is to the north, the west, and part of the south. For instance, the Philippines, we wouldn't be seeing today in the South China Sea the building of those fake little islands if the Philippines hadn't demanded the withdrawal of the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force from Subic Bay and from Clark Airfield. China never would have done what it did in South China Sea, building those fake islands, if the Philippines hadn't essentially thrown the Americans out. Now, it is what it is. The Americans are kind of trying to go back to the Philippines, but the die has been cast. Those islands are built. China saw a weakness there, and they went in and they filled it. But going down from the South China Sea, and that's a whole other discussion, that the next stop is Indonesia. And then after Indonesia is Australia. What are your thoughts about China's perception of Australia? Of course, Australia is the kind of the sentinel, the sentry, if you will, to the Indian Ocean. The Indian Ocean, of course, is traversed by Chinese tankers going to the Middle East for its oil, to Africa for its natural resources. So how do you see China's view of Australia?
Well, first of all, just to respond very briefly to the way you introduced that question, it's important to point out from an Australian perspective that when you list off those different countries that are going, the different great powers that are going to inhibit China's ambitions, you, I think, notably left out Southeast Asia, because yes, there is no great power in Southeast Asia right now that can constrain China's ambitions. So it is a more natural outlet for Chinese ambitions than those other parts of Asia. And that is something that Australians, I think, need to worry about more. And it's also a reason why I think we should be encouraging Indonesia as much as we can, because it is the only country in Southeast Asia that can be a great power. And I think it's very much in Australia's interest that it should develop that kind of personality and that kind of strength. To go directly to your question, it's important, first of all, to point out that Australia is important to China as an exporter of raw materials, in particular iron ore. So there is no other country in the world that can export iron ore at the scale or of the quality that Australia can. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's a kind of it's a relationship of codependency. So Australia has benefited enormously from China's economic growth over the last 30 years. It's kept us out of recession for the most part, and contributed to our sustained economic growth of our economy. And China, in turn, has a dependency on our iron ore supplies, as well as other raw commodities. But iron ore is the most important one, which is used to make steel. And that has been, you know, hugely important for China's development, not least, you know, the steel that makes those high-speed rail lines. So that economic partnership is very important to note. Strategically, I don't think Australia is all that important to China. It is important primarily as an ally of the United States. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about AUKUS, and in particular the the kind of basing arrangements that you referred to in your introduction is that it makes Australia a more prominent target for China.
That's true.
We're going to have bombers, US strategic bombers based at one of our northern air bases. And we are going to have, as you said, a rotation of American nuclear-powered submarines in Western Australia. And so for the first time at those facilities, we will have US assets conducting operational missions from Australian soil. That hasn't happened since World War II. And that makes those bases targets for China in a way that Australia hasn't been in the past. We've also hosted US intelligence and communications facilities for a long time, which would also be targets, no doubt. But this does make Australia more prominent for Chinese war planners.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And the intelligence, of course, I think you're referring to Pine Gap, to that
That's right.
intelligence gathering establishment in Central Australia. But let's come back to the concerns that the average Australian would have. On the one hand, you have both political parties, the Coalition and the Australian Labor Party, which seem to be supportive of AUKUS, number one. AUKUS would be supplying these nuclear submarines into the 2040s, a good 20 years into the future. So it's a very long-term program. Playing the devil's advocate, yes, and in a sense, having American bombers in the north of Australia, having American and British attack submarines in the west of Australia would obviously make Australia a target. But maybe flipping that around, isn't it true that the best defense is an offense? And if take as the offense the fact that Australia has those assets, British and American submarines based in Western Australia and airfields in Northern Australia.
I don't question the logic. The best defense can be a good offense, but
yes.
You've got to be confident. You've got to be confident you'll win. And I think increasingly we have reason to doubt that the United States, even with the support of allies like Australia, would win a war against China. And the odds are probably lengthening on that question simply because the resources that China can throw at its military expansion, particularly its maritime expansion, mm-hmm. are going to be greater than those of the United States. There are all sorts of debates about China's defense budget. But up to now, the consensus is that they've spent about 2% of their GDP on their military. They already have the largest navy in the world, at least in terms of hull numbers, not in terms of raw tonnage. But they're on track to have the largest navy in the world. They're only committed, really, to the Asia-Pacific. They don't have global commitments the way that the US has, so they can concentrate their forces more. And as I said, they're only spending about 2% of GDP. So in national terms, they're barely breaking a sweat. Mm-hmm. They could easily afford to spend more, even with a slightly slowing economy. So I think the odds are lengthening that, you know, with an offensive strategy that the US could actually win. And so you have to ask yourself, well, what's the alternative? And you also have to ask yourself, even if the United States could win, it would still be incredibly costly.
Yes.
Such a war. And does the United States have the national resolve for, you know, to win that kind of contest? And that takes me back to the previous answer. I don't think ultimately that the United States does have that kind of resolve because there's not enough skin in the game.
Let's come back to the average Australian. My point is both parties, both the Coalition Party and the Australian Labor Party, are both supportive of AUKUS. But what about the average Australian? Is there support for AUKUS? Is there opposition to it? Where does the man and woman in the street stand on AUKUS? And because it's going to be a very expensive long-term project.
Yeah, I don't have the numbers to hand, but we have polled on this, and the support is fairly robust for AUKUS. Australians do rather recoil at the price. It's what Americans call sticker shock, which is in Australian dollars is has been announced as being up to $368 billion.
Yes.
Now that's, as you mentioned earlier, that's over several decades, so it's affordable for Australia. We can pay for it. It's just a question of opportunity cost. What else could we be doing with this money? And in fact, defence policy generally. You know, makes up far less of our government spending than health spending, for instance, or welfare and education and so on. So it's still very much affordable for Australia. Look, as I said, support, there is support there for AUKUS. My own view about public opinion on these questions is that where the public has little information, it is not deeply informed, it tends to look to its leaders. And so that's, I think generally the public is not terribly involved, the Australian public is not closely involved with foreign policy. And so they look to their leaders. And because there is bipartisan support for AUKUS, I don't think it's at all surprising to see that reflected in public opinion.
Aren't there some other elements of the AUKUS plan? Of course, it's primarily 8 nuclear-powered submarines. But aren't there some other elements, some other technology like undersea drones, supercomputers? Aren't there other elements of AUKUS?
Right. So the submarine project is known as AUKUS Pillar 1. And you're referring to AUKUS Pillar 2, which takes in all sorts of exotic technologies, including, yes, drones, both airborne and undersea. It also takes in areas like artificial intelligence, hypersonic weapons, and several others that I've just forgotten about on the moment. Right now, AUKUS Pillar 2 kind of resembles a negotiation over a free trade agreement. So essentially what the three sides are trying to do is to bring their national procedures and their national guidelines in place so that the three countries can cooperate with each other unimpeded by restrictions on official secrets, for instance. There's even talk of something called an AUKUS visa, so that specialists, engineers and scientists who work in these areas can, you know, easily jump from one jurisdiction to the other.
One aspect of the Echidna strategy that we haven't talked about yet is the Pacific Union. Of course, Australia looks to the South Pacific and the island nations of the South Pacific, Fiji, Vanuatu, the Solomon Islands, all of that collection of, I didn't even mention New Zealand, but I don't think New Zealand would be included in the Pacific Union if it would be. Talk to us about the potential for Chinese encroachment into the South Pacific. Of course, they have that agreement with the Solomon Islands. What's Australia's policy towards that possible expansion of China into the South Pacific? And is the Pacific Union a way to prevent that from happening?
Yeah, so I said at the beginning that I regard distance as Australia's single biggest defence asset. If there's a threat to that defence asset, it would be if China developed several military bases close to our shores. And the obvious place to do that is in the Pacific Islands region. And so Australia is very, very sensitive about Chinese influence, Chinese incursions into that part of the world. And there were credible reports that emerged a few years ago of China approaching the government of Vanuatu and the government of Papua New Guinea about possibly hosting Chinese military assets on their territory. Whether that would have amounted to full-scale, you know, basing arrangement, perhaps a naval base or an air base, who's to say? But in any case, Australian diplomacy and statecraft with some help from the United States seemed to turn those two countries around. It didn't stop the Solomon Islands from developing agreeing to a security pact with China. That's mostly about policing and about domestic security, allowing Chinese police, for instance, to come on shore to protect Chinese assets in the Solomon Islands. So it's not a military agreement as such, but nevertheless, you can imagine that it has made Australian officials very, very nervous. And so what I've proposed in the book is that rather than Australia continually trying to play whack-a-mole in the region, trying to put out these little fires, what we could aim for is a much more comprehensive agreement with our Pacific neighbours, as you say, a kind of Pacific Union roughly modelled on the European Union, whereby we bring the countries together in such a close economic embrace that it helps them economically. These countries are very small and they're very difficult to sustain without foreign assistance. So it helps them economically. They can export workers. They can benefit from remittance incomes to Australia. But the quid pro quo would be that you would never host a military base on your soil for a foreign power. Mm-hmm. So it's an economic solution to a security problem, which is actually what the EU was as well.
Yes, Well, Sam, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what are your closing thoughts about the future of AUKUS and the Echidna strategy? Could the two possibly be complementary?
I guess my closing thought about AUKUS is that in the end, none of the strategic arguments that I make in the book, and which I've some of which I've made to you today, they may end up all being irrelevant, simply because what will undermine the AUKUS project is not the high-minded kind of strategic thinking about, you know, China's intentions and its military capabilities. But in the end, what will sink AUKUS, if you'll forgive the pun, is just that it's so difficult. It is just such a difficult project. As I began at the, as I said at the beginning, you know, it's such a massive enterprise for a small country like Australia with no expertise in nuclear engineering and nuclear technology and safety to take on, that I think what we should expect to see over the coming years is a steady drip feed of news about project delays and cost overruns. And eventually the political capital will start to erode as well alongside those problems. And at that point, we could see Australia back away from it, and AUKUS may survive in its Pillar 2 form, but Pillar 1, the nuclear submarine, could wind up being a, you know, a casualty, and we end up going back to the plan A of acquiring new diesel-electric submarines. Mm-hmm. As for my book, look, it's stirred a debate, which is exactly what I wanted. The reaction to the book in Australia has been far beyond what I expected. I don't expect by any means for a government to embrace it, but what you do hope is that you know, as a policy wonk say, you want to open the Overton window, which is to say to, widen the bounds of acceptable discussion on policy issues. And I hope that's what I've done.
And Sam, where can our listeners buy a copy of the book, The Echidna Strategy?
Well, American listeners have to buy it on Amazon or other online book retailers. If you're in Australia, it's still available in all bookshops.
And Sam, are you working on any other new projects?
Yes, I am. So in line with the comments I made earlier about Indonesia, I'm actually publishing an essay in Australia's big journal for these issues is a quarterly journal called Australian Foreign Affairs. And they will be publishing an essay of mine in about a month's time, which argues for effectively a military alliance between Australia and Indonesia. It wouldn't be an alliance in name, because the Indonesians are very nervous about that term alliance. You know, they're committed to not being aligned with any power formally, but informally it would have all the makings of a military alliance, and basically designed to make sure that China can never be the dominant power in maritime Southeast Asia.
And Sam, how can our listeners contact you? Website, X handle?
Yeah, so you can contact me via the Lowy Institute website. There's a contact form on there. But yes, I'm also on X at Sam Roggeveen, all one word. And well, the spelling is Roggeveen.
And LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram?
Tend to stay off those. X has been very good to me.
Okay. Sam Roggeveen of the Lowy Institute, talking to us today from Canberra, Australia. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
And for our listeners, today's episode is number 517. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, or wherever you listen to your podcast, and join our audience in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking us number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.